This week on Into the Wormhole.
You're on leave. Please disembark this station.
The Wormhole, your weekly Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, where two longtime Star Trek fans take a series newbie into the Gamma Quadrant and
beyond.
I'm your host, Poe Gordon. We are sans co-host Ben this week. He is stuck in a Cardassian prison awaiting trial, but we already know that he is guilty.
No, Ben, no!
I do have with me our Star Trek newbie, Vince.
My name is Vince Wormhole. My rank is Chief Officer. I am a Federation citizen.
You know, I was expecting him to drop the name, rank, serial number trope there. But no, it was just the Federation citizen thing, I guess. This week we are talking about the episode The Tribunal, episode 25 of season 2. Our 48th episode, approaching a big milestone of 50. Production code 405-12-445. First aired June 5th, 1994. O'Brien is put on trial by the Cardassians after being accused of working with the Marquis. This one,
I like how you say Marquis.
Did I say Marquis? The Maquis?
Like the Marquis matchup.
Yeah, the Marquis. The sign is what accused him. He was working with them.
The Marquis.
Yeah, I actually... This was a very... uneven episode. I didn't love it. I liked things about it, but it wasn't as strong as I remembered, because I actually did remember this one, and I was kind of anticipating it, and then just kind of, I don't know. What do you think? Just rough thoughts, first of all?
I kind of liked it. I think it had its some shortcomings to make it, you know, a really amazing episode, but I thought it was kind of good, actually.
Yeah, it had good moments. Like, there's things about it I enjoyed. I think it's just inconsistencies, and we'll get to that. A little background on this episode. It was written by Bill Dial. As far as I know, the only other episode he's written of Deep Space Nine was The Alternate. And that was the one with Odo and the monster, and Odo meets his father.
The monster.
He's, like, turning into a monster. There's like he meets his not.
It's funny you should say that, because I feel like a connection there. I can see some similarities in the style.
Yeah, they're definitely,
now that you say that.
Yeah, there definitely is like a I don't know, like a tonal like similarity. But this one is really notable because it's the first one directed, the first of a few episodes directed by Avery Brooks.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Captain Sisko himself, and I. You know, I didn't notice anything specific to him that separated this from other episodes, but at the same time, he didn't hurt it, you know?
Yeah, I wish I would have remembered we talked about that before I watched it, because I might have been watching closely the angles and the transitions and a lot of stuff that I assume as a director he might have some control over, the kind of the feel of it and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely...
the performance.
Yeah. He mentions that he really liked working with what's his name, Colmini, a lot specifically, and it's definitely his episode, a Colmini episode for sure. You know, and
although I would say one of the strengths is the Odo's performance.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely is a Colmini episode for sure.
This is I would say part three in a series of from the O'Brien Must Suffer series.
You will suffer.
I say part three because I guess I'm thinking part two is the one where the Whispers, where it's like the clone or the replicant O'Brien, but it's not our.
Oh yeah.
But it's not our O'Brien, so does it count? I don't know. But
that's true.
The important thing is we see an O'Brien suffering in that episode, and that's all that really matters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking of suffering, this is a slight tangent, but last week we talked about. Contact and First Contact, and you made a joke about, well, that was the first contact I saw. Did you know that this week in real life history is this the week that Contact premiered in theaters?
Really? Yeah. That's kind of weird.
Isn't that weird? Good time.
That is super weird.
Good timing in our
program. It's also weird because, maybe not weird, but we're officially into the summer episodes because this aired in June. And we sit here today as we record it, July 6th. Is it the 6th?
Yeah, we're almost...
So we're in a similar time as the folks who watched this episode were watching it.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird to think about, too. Because, you know, you got to put it into perspective as far as what's going on when you're watching DS9, and that's that none of the fall shows yet, no football... as far as like sports world, I'm just kind of trying to picture what it was like to watch Deep Space Nine when it first came out, and June feels like kind of the perfect time.
Yeah. I mean, and I imagine too, you have all summer to hopefully see the repeats to catch up if you missed anything. Mm-hmm. But this is sort of the period where like, okay, TV, I mean, this is how it used to be, and people, younger listeners who might not remember this, but when the summer hits, TV takes a break. There's nothing on. There's just a lot of crap. And usually the shows that come out, it's not like this at all anymore, but the shows that would come out in the summer, that premiere in the summer, were usually bad. That's where things went to die. You start getting the flagship shows like, Deep Space Nines and your Voyagers and your Home Improvements and Seinfelds. And they all go to bed in the summer.
Now, I guess you could say, though, the other side of it, it's a bunch of bad TV, but it's also a chance for some of the more, the kind of more creative shows, for networks to take a chance.
Yeah.
So I think, you get a bunch of crap, but you also get the Deep Space Nines of the world. In the summertime.
Yeah, because then,
which I don't know if that ever changed. Maybe eventually they changed to a fall schedule. I don't know.
No, they're always in.
They're always kind of a summer show.
No, they're fall. It's just that this it's just a long series, so. It just runs into. I mean, this season's almost over. There's only one episode left, so it'll be done.
Now wait a second. If it's showing in June, and it's almost over, that's not a summer show.
No, because it ends in it. The next episode, it's going to end in June 13th. So that's off until September, October maybe. So it's a fall.
Wow.
It's a fall show.
I guess I think of fall shows as starting in the fall, taking a huge winter break, and being over by March.
Well, it used to be. It's like that.
Not that it's strict.
It's like that now.
Necessarily.
And it's like that now because series don't really run 26 episodes anymore. I mean, some do, but most TV shows now will run like 15 or 13, especially like, you have like these more prestige shows like Game of Thrones. They run 8 episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, these extended schedules, these extended like television orders, they don't happen that much because they're too expensive. Mm-hmm. People cut cords now, so there's no need to really like work your whole TV show around like sweeps and these fall and summer schedules anymore. So like,
I think you're right. Yeah, that I think the whole system's blown up at this point.
Oh yeah,
because
it is.
Like Game of Thrones airs at one of the worst TV times of all time, but it's such a strong show, it feels like it can stand on its own. It doesn't care. In fact, it's an advantage for them, I think. So you're right. I think that rather than going with the flow now, TV shows really could give a shit less, especially not even mentioning the fact that shows drop all at once now sometimes on Netflix and whatnot.
Yeah, you can binge.
But still, interesting to remember how it would have been for folks watching it. Although, I wonder, this might be a good question for any listeners, is how many folks even watched it when it first came out versus how many have seen it, like you and Ben, both for the most part, were a lot of reruns, right?
Yeah, I didn't see it when it was live. I saw it, I knew it was airing, but I was watching Star Trek. I just wasn't watching this. I was one of those people. And like, I really only even saw it because of DVR. And that's how I was able to sort of, dig into it. Because it was pre Netflix streaming, but it was like right about when I can just record these every night. I'd get it like they do two a night on Spike TV, and I just watch them that way. Ben, I think, watched it live. So
yeah, towards the end, I think.
Yeah,
the last few seasons, I think he did watch it live.
Yeah, I'm gonna make that our question of the week because I'm actually genuinely curious.
That's a stupid question.
I'm curious. If you're a listener, and did you watch this show when it was live, or did you kind of catch up onto it later? And like, what was it like watching it live with like the lulls and the summer breaks and all that stuff? Like, what was that effect like? Because especially like they start to really end the seasons on some cliffhangers, and I'm just curious what that effect was like.
And I would love to hear from some bingers because I wouldn't even consider myself a Star Trek Deep Space Nine binger because we sort of stagger this out so that we can record the podcast. So I essentially watch an episode of a week, more or less. That's not binging. I'm almost kind of watching it as the viewers did at first. But I'd love to hear from any listeners who have recently just straight up binged it.
Yeah,
I know at least one fan of the show, J.A. or whatever, Joe, fan of the show. He told me that like he puts it on like just while he's getting ready, like just hanging out.
I just puts it on. The only reason I don't do that now is because I want to keep it fresh for this, and I don't want to rewatch things that I'm gonna have to like talk about. But I do that with Next Generation. I will just put on like an episode and just like it's just background noise, or if I'm like writing or something, I just have it on. It's one of those shows where like I just always kind of have in my back pocket. Even sometimes, when some of these the bad episodes, I had to like go back and like skip ahead to like the later seasons and just sort of like rinse my mouth out with the good episodes, just to be reminded. Oh wait, the show is good. I do want to keep watching
It's going somewhere.
Yeah.
And if you have never heard this before and you don't already know this, wormholepodcast@gmail.com is our email address. So if you want to chime in, you can chime in there. Twitter @wormholepodcast. And Facebook, Into the Wormhole Podcast, you can search. I don't know if there's a URL for that. But yeah, let us know how you consumed Deep Space Nine, because we're very interested to see some of the differences and how you experienced it.
For sure.
And that's a huge side.
Yeah, that's okay, though. I mean, it's all part of the... it's all part of the... I think it's relevant. I mean, you know, because as much as this is a Star Trek show, I think it's also like a 90s pop culture show in some ways. And we touch on that stuff enough. And it's not just... Because like anybody could do this show, but I think what makes it work is it's our experiences. It's like how we view these things under our lens and like where we were when they happened. And like, I think that stuff's important. So even if it seems like it's game derailed, it's you know, it's part of our show. So let's talk about the episode. Some more background stuff. So it's based off of I did a lot of research on this one. I have like three pages of notes. I don't know how much we'll get into them, but
good, let's hear it.
I love that. This one was based off of a statement made by Gul Dukat in the Maquis Part 2, where he's talking to Sisko about the Cardassian legal system. I don't know if you remember that. And he says that...
Oh, I do remember
that. Verdict is always the same. They know the outcome, and the trial is always the same. And they literally base the whole episode off of that idea. That idea into Cardassian lore. Really digs into, like, further digging into the Cardassian need to place the state above everything else. We saw glimpses of that with what's his face? Garrick, when he gives Bashir the book. First appearance of Cardassia Prime. So we actually see some, you know, little background shots of Cardassia, which is kind of cool.
This is the first time that I see Cardassia.
Yeah.
So outdoor shots.
There's a couple. I thought there was one, like a establishing shot.
Maybe there was.
I mean, it was brief, but like at the very least, we see like some of the set design. Not set design, but like the environment. Like the set design here was very, this is something I also researched pretty heavily. It was very heavily tied into the theme of the episode and like what influenced it. They repurposed one of the holodeck or holosuite sets. They kind of repainted it and all that. But the production designer, Herman Zimmerman, was very heavily inspired by George Orwell.
Hans Zimmer. Love his stuff.
I know. I wonder if it's the same guy, but it's Herman Zimmerman. It was very heavily inspired by George Orwell, specifically 1984.
Of course.
Which, yeah.
The video screens.
Yeah.
That was so Big Brother.
Oh, yeah.
That's the first thing I thought of is, here I see the cityscape, and across the buildings are these huge videos of some huge head, which is the state, you know, spewing its propaganda. And that's the first thing I thought of was, wow, this is very Big Brother.
Yeah.
1984.
For listeners who don't know, just a little background. If you don't know 1984, it's a novel written by George Orwell in 1948. It depicts a dystopian society that is under constant surveillance of the government, and they're in a state of perpetual war. So everything is just adherence to the state, Big Brother, like all that kind of surveillance state stuff. It is very much in keeping with the theme of Cardassia. The set designer commented that... He wanted the set to be, in his words, Spartan, uncompromising, and merciless. All adjectives that he would accurately use to describe Cardassia. I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah.
And this is also another...
You did a good job, I think.
Oh, yeah, it looks great. Like, they don't do a ton of... I mean, sometimes their external sets are hit or miss. Like, you get, like, the Palm Springs, Florida planet, which is... yeah. But then you get stuff like this where it's, like, it really adds an atmosphere to it. You know, the lighting, too, in the courtroom scene was just really, like, suffocating.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder how much of that was Avery Brooks, like, you know, the way he chose the, you know... focus the camera lens on, because like the way the arbiter, the judge, was sort of always positioned, she's always like on high, and you know, how much of that was camera work, how much of that was set design, like that was really cool.
Oh yeah, and every time you see Odo and then they're looking up,
yeah so they're just it's like the ultimate authority is visually out of reach of them, it's above them, and it is all encompassing. Another interesting, just one more Brave New World tangent, or not Brave New World, I always get 1984 and Brave New World mixed up in my head.
I've never read Brave New World.
That's good. I think it's a little more depressing than, 1984, but that's a...
1984 was kind of exciting, yeah, I feel like.
Yeah, it's, Brave New World is, like, heartbreaking in a way. So in the, when we mentioned this episode before, there's a Star Trek Next Generation episode called Chain of Command. There's a Cardassian played by noted Shakespearean actor David Warner. And basically, one of the notable scenes in the episode is him torturing Picard for, like, the whole episode. And there's a scene in there that heavily mirrors 1984, where he's asking him, how many lights do you see? And there's four lights, and he's trying to get him to say five. And that's almost a direct scene from Brave, or from 1984. Instead of fingers, instead of lights.
Yeah. Oh. Four lights.
But then also, coincidentally enough, in the 1954 BBC teleplay of 1984, one of the characters was played by Peter Cushing, who you may not recognize as Grand Moff Tarkin.
Oh. But
I thought that was kind of
Peter Cushing.
Yeah, he played, I forget the character's name, but yeah, he was in a teleplay. It was just a random, like...
It was some Star Wars, Star Trek crossover.
Yeah, I got sucked into a rabbit hole when I was looking at that, so I thought I'd mention it. but yeah, so I guess we'll get into the plot a little bit. Some more stuff I can jump to later. So yeah, Brian is about to go on vacation, and everybody is, he's fussing over every little bit of tech on the station, every little thing he has to do, and they're just... kind of over it. Like, we get it, we'll take care of it. So he leaves.
What trope is that? Is there anything you can think of off the top of your head, a sitcom where they're supposed to be on vacation, they can't leave their work?
It's fussy.
I thought the whole episode was gonna be like,
yeah,
that.
Like O'Brien. Not
thankfully it wasn't.
This probably,
I just can picture it like a Home Improvement episode or something where he's like trying to fix a car or something.
Yeah.
You know, or it's like when they're supposed to be on vacation and he just can't stop or whatever.
Tim, are you trying to put a motor in that water cooler? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably a name for that on TV Tropes, which I'll have to look it up later. But I'm not sure what the specific reference would be. But yeah, that's definitely like a famous, like, the guy can't stop working and... You know, it's a little like, I thought it was a little bit eye-rolly when he's in the ship with Keiko, and he's like, I just want to look at these tech manuals, and she's very like, I thought we were going to have vacation, honey, and it was so 90s.
It got steamy, too.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
It got real steamy.
And we've seen
that's the steamiest I've ever seen on Deep Space Nine.
I mean, Keiko and O'Brien tend to get a little bit, They have a very healthy sex life, I would say. Just
yeah,
based on what we've
she's
seen.
Like, tilt this thing back. She's like, doesn't the seat go back?
I know, like right away.
And she's like, I'll make it worth your while, hubba hubba.
Yeah, put away those.
Oh, shit.
Put away those manuals and get your engineering hands on me. yeah, they tend to always almost go at it. So then O'Brien, they get stopped by a Cardassian ship. Oh, real quick, I can't believe I missed this. This is the huge thing. Right before O'Brien's leaving the station, he runs into a guy named Boone. Boone served with him, apparently, aboard the Rutledge. Now, you may not remember this, and obviously I don't know why you would, but they've talked a lot about O'Brien's backstory and his time in the Cardassian like war, when the Federation had a war with the front. They talk a lot about it in this episode, but the Rutledge... was a ship that we learn about in Next Generation. And this is really the first episode we see O'Brien get his own arc, and we meet the captain of the Rutledge, and he's this is also the first episode where we meet the Cardassians in Star Trek. But remember the sound clip I played where the O'Brien is singing the Irish song?
Mm-hmm.
That's the episode where we learn about the Rutledge and like his old crew. We don't learn about Boone. He just sort of brought in this time kind of for a I guess a callback to that, which is kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
So that guy left Starfleet. He hasn't been in since the war, some 8 years, I think they establish. And
well, what I didn't like about this scene is it was too obvious.
Yeah, it really was.
I feel like
that's
to the point where I was just thinking about it the entire episode. Obviously, O'Brien's about to get into some real trouble with the Cardassians, and the entire time, I'm thinking, well, he was behind it, and we'll get to it. There is a twist, but it felt so after the fact, added on at the end, like, oh, by the way,
yeah.
So like, it was for the most part, not to cut you off.
No, you're fine.
That Boone, they run into each other and they basically discuss old times, but it's a brief meeting, and I thought it was a little awkward because, you know, he says, well, their experience together. Well, the way he experienced war is what made him get out of Starfleet, and that's what made O'Brien stay in it.
Yeah.
So it was supposed to show that kind of contrast between how they viewed it, or at least how he told you he viewed it.
Yeah, I liked that moment. I was expecting the episode, and I sort of forgot at one point, but I think I was expecting it to dig into their relationship more. And it's sort of like you said, he's just it's so obvious why he's there that... Mm-hmm. He's just there for the sake of plot. So it was kind of...
A prop.
Yeah, he's just a prop. And, like, I don't know if we're meant to be... I mean, there's a twist at the end I think we're supposed to be surprised about. But we're kind of not because we know he's involved from the get-go. We just don't know how. So it's the details are, I guess, what's meant to be surprising. I don't know how that works. But, yeah, that aspect of it was sort of a little uneven. O'Brien gets taken. He gets charged with working with the Maquis. They don't even tell him. He just gets charged, taken. He's knocked unconscious and he's thrown into prison. And they've already pronounced him guilty. And we learn that Cardassian legal system is you're guilty from the start. Once they decide that you've done something wrong, that's it. And the whole purpose of the trial isn't about proving your innocence like we would think it is. It's about putting up a good show. To demonstrate how effective and beautiful the state is, really, which is chilling, and you know, obviously meant to have.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say what I loved about this is it's easy to forget the Cardassians, why you're supposed to hate them, why they are essentially villains, because the show has done a pretty decent job offering you these kind of a little more round characters in Gul Dukat. Not that he's good, but you're figuring him out. You're trying to understand Gul Dukat. You've got, of course, Simple Gary, the tailor.
Simple Gary,
And he is also kind of a round character. So it's easy to forget that the Cardassian state is awful. That it's a fascist state. That their judicial system is a sham. And this reminds you. So just in case you started to like or get soft to the Cardassians, this episode, I think, comes at a great time in the world building to remind you how awful they can be.
And
they did a good job because the whole thing is just, it's terrifying. And they go from 0 to 100 so fast because 1 minute they're on vacation. And then the next he's literally getting his tooth pulled out.
Yeah, they go to work
and
on
being
him.
Beaten up.
Yeah,
and accused and already sentenced, for a very serious crime. So that was wild.
Yeah, these scenes were pretty. This is where we really get to the O'Brien must suffer part of the episode. I mean, they go to work on him, and it was like. I was stressed at how, you know, much they were just beating the crap out of him. One more quick note. So the goal who tells the Cardassian that tells him to stand down and place him under arrest is Ghul Evek. We've seen him before. He was the one that O'Brien spoke to about helping remove the voles from the station.
Oh, and he was a real dick about it. He's like, it's your station now. You figure it out.
Yeah. So it was neat little bit of continuity to see him back.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, they you know basically beat the crap out of him and. It's like you know they're not gonna kill him, but like,
right?
You don't like. I'm immediately thinking, how the hell is he gonna get out of this? Like, he's not. He's screwed. So they go to work on him physically. They mention and this turns out to be really important. They pull one of his molars out, and I guess that's tradition in these Cardassian interrogations, prison situations. And they keep asking him, you know, questions, and he's just like. No, I'm not. He just, Federation citizen, name, ranks, serial number, that kind of thing. Keeps dropping that. So we get another Cardassian who comes in, and she seems a little calm. She apologizes. She starts treating him a little better. Her name is Makbar. She's the chief archon of their legal system. Mm-hmm. And she...
Which I wasn't clear at first what she was.
Yeah.
But clearly she's like a... judge.
Yeah, that's the best way to...
But at first I thought maybe she was going to be his lawyer or what have you.
Yeah, they kind of sell it. Like, because she's there to like speak on his behalf or whatever. But and this is very... I think also that this is... Her presence and her acting and like her demeanor is also very Cardassian. Because she's very polite and comfortable and like calming and like, oh, no. This is all being, you know, we're just here to... You know, this will all be cleared up in a matter of moments and... You know, we're going to get you the best legal counsel we can provide, all the while knowing he doesn't understand, he doesn't understand, like, the ins and outs of their legal system. So, and she still leaves him there, but she's kind of lulling him into a, you know, false sense of security.
Yeah, for them, it's all about order. And, you know, all the goals we've met, everyone we've met never gets too crazy high. Sure, they get a little animated sometimes and passionate about things, but... It's in their mind, it's all in the name of order. That's their justification, is what I'm starting to learn. Everything is about keeping order.
Yeah, yeah.
And that everything has its place, and this is how it's always been. And what would you have? Chaos is what their response is, you know?
And we had learned in that that episode I referenced, Chain of Command, where the one that references 1984, we learned that the Cardassian people were constantly warring with each other. It was constant... fighting until the military took over and basically like created order. So now anything that threatens that sense of order in any way is you know deemed a threat. And
that could be part of the narrative too.
Yeah,
maybe I'm wrong here.
No.
That's just what they tell their citizens, that hundreds of years ago, you know, all we did was war each other, and that's the only reason that we're not, is because of these rules that you must follow. And you come to believe it eventually.
Yeah.
Whereas it's probably a lot more complicated and nuanced.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. Yeah. But
that's what is kind of neat about this episode, is kind of, for me, coming new and fresh, is learning about Cardassian culture, but also getting just a more of a window into their whole government and their whole way of life.
Yeah.
And it does not look fun.
No, not at all. And like it really makes you feel for what the Bajorans probably went under. Like, sure. This is how they treat their citizens, you know. We've seen plenty of examples of how badly they were treated, but it just further emphasizes just, you know, and how, why they're not a part of the Federation, why they're, you know, Cold War enemies. And so we go back to the station, and there's a neat little line from Sisko where they're talking about the, you know, O'Brien situation, and he tells her that Starfleet Command has ordered a bunch of ships to the border. Most notably, two of them is the Valdemar, the Prokoviev, and the Enterprise. So that was pretty cool, because they're mentioning the Enterprise. That's the ship from Next Generation.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah,
actually.
I mean, why would you? Like, again, you've never seen it, so. But yeah, it's a neat little nod. And the part of the reason they did that is because... this is the first episode of Star Trek to air after Next Gen is over. So the episode, I think Next Gen aired like an hour before or a day before this, but the series finale of it was right before this episode. So, like, that was just a neat little nod to, like, oh, the Enterprise is still out there, even though, you know, it's you're not going to see any more of its adventures on TV.
Which reminded me of, they referenced a Hideki class ship.
Yeah.
Which, the first thing I think of is Hideki Mitsui, Japanese baseball player. Made his mark, obviously, there, but also with the Yankees.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did have a brief tenure with the Rays as well.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the only two teams he played for, or he played for anyone else?
No, no, he did... I mean, it was mostly the Yankees where he was good, and Godzilla was his nickname, I think.
Yeah, yeah, he was Godzilla. When he left the Rays, didn't he try to go somewhere else or no?
He may have. He was much older by then. He's definitely one of those players who didn't come to the States until he had already had quite a career. Yeah. So he was not young by any means. But anyways, Hideki class, thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Where they get these ship names from.
Yeah, this is a good opportunity for this.
That was the...
I want to know what the hell is going on!
So yeah, obviously Hideki class. There's various classes of ships in Starfleet. Mm-hmm. So like shuttle class is like the runabouts. Hideki class is a smaller one. The Enterprise is a galaxy class starship. There's not a ton of those in the fleet. Those are like the Enterprise is actually the flagship of Starfleet. Mm-hmm. So like for them to send it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the flagship. So that is like the ship.
I had no idea.
And that's one thing I think that's neat about Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is like, you know, it's just for the beginning. It's just this little podunk station out in the outskirts of nowhere. These are kind of the grunts of Starfleet. The Enterprise is like the big guns. That is like the bread and butter of Starfleet. So, and like, you know, kind of shows you O'Brien's pedigree because he served there for so long. And also makes sense that they might have a vested interest in like a bit of off war, like headcanon stuff. You know, they might have a vested interest in making sure they can do something at the border to make sure he's okay once they hear he's being held captive by the Cardassians. Like it's like so much depth to a throwaway line, I think. That's, you know, really just meant to be an Easter egg. But Keiko is pretty convinced that he's being tortured because of things he's told her about his stay with Cardassians when he was a prisoner on Setlik 3. That's where a lot of his like trauma comes from, the stuff he experienced there. And Odo's kind of like, well, you know, we do know for sure that he's being tortured. I can tell you that. But
typical Odo.
Yeah, very matter of fact. You know, Sisko's like, well, we don't even know where he is. So, and this is where the episode feels a little uneven for me. And not uneven, but I just didn't buy this part of character development. So Sisko and Odo, they go with Keiko to Ops. Major Kira jumps in and Cardassia Prime, Mackbar, she's like, I'm representing the Cardassian Empire against Miles O'Brien. You guys can't speak with him, but he's being treated really well. And so we're just going to let you know what happens as the trial. We're going to let you know why he's being charged as the trial proceeds, because that's how we do things. Like, you learn as we go, basically. And he's already guilty. So we're just here to tell you how we figured out he was guilty. So...
And it was uneven why? What part didn't you buy?
I guess we're not quite there yet. But it had to do with Kira. And we'll get there. So we learned that the only people allowed to go, like, Sisko's like, I'll be there. And she's like, no, only family members and a Nestor, who's like an advisor, who's like basically his defense attorney. Odo says, she's like, well, you can't come. And he's like, actually, I can, because when I was a chief executive or chief security officer of the station under Gul Dukat, he made me an officer so I could testify. So I have, you know, the rights of a Cardassian Nestor, and I can go. I'm going to be his defense attorney, basically.
Technicality.
Yeah, and I thought that was actually a really cool bit of world building, because it totally makes sense. It's 100% like reasonable. It makes sense, and it's something that like, it wasn't forced for him to be there.
Mm-hmm. I was relieved at that point.
Yeah,
I was like, thank God. I was like, wow, how is this gonna work? Is this gonna be Keiko alone on Cardassia, and no one's gonna have to save the day? So definitely very relieved to know that hard ass Odo was gonna go there.
Thank you.
Yeah, like, oh, I kind of feel like, oh, like, Odo's gonna help him. Like, you kind of felt like, good, he has someone in his corner. And you kind of, at least if you're anything like me, I was thinking Odo's gonna be the one to save the day now. He's gonna do his thing, mm-hmm. and he's gonna, you know, solve the crime.
Yeah, maybe turn into a gavel or something. Yeah, or hide somewhere. But he didn't do any of that. You know, and I think this is a good time for me to explain the strength of the episode, or maybe the strength of the premise. It, for me personally, was terrifying because I think of this all the time, and there's movies based on it. Of course, it's happened in real life, too. In fact, just recently in real life, there was the American citizen who was detained in North Korea for taking a poster down. And he had no choice but to live by their laws, their court system, suffer their punishment, even though none of those things would apply in the U.S. Obviously, that'd be a huge... what in America is referred to as, you know, crimes against like humanity and stuff. But it's just so scary to think you could be in a country that has different norms, that has different a different court system, a different way of proving innocence, and you're just boned. There's nothing even your home country can do, and that's exactly what this is. So it's like when the teenagers get convinced to hide drugs. Smuggle drugs into, and they get caught in, you know, some other country, and these, you know, American teenagers all of a sudden find themselves facing a life in prison or something crazy. And that's what this reminded me of, and that terrifies me. And so I was terrified and felt that way for O'Brien. So I think it really worked on that level.
Yeah,
it was really terrifying, especially until we know, okay, Odo's on board, we have a shot.
Yeah,
and then you start to finally feel a little better.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, and just imagine how that feels for people who live in this country, and like when they get arrested for something, like, because, you know, that happens sometimes. People get arrested for things they didn't do, and they get falsely accused, and like, you know, the way police tend to stereotype people, like, I almost feel like in some ways it's worse. Like, you're from this country, you are supposed to be a part of those these supposed rights, and they're not respected, like.
I agree. It's much worse for the people that live there.
Yeah.
But I think it's a more of a surprise. It's something you would never expect. You do something that is normally a minor offense or not an offense at all, and you're used to all these things, and then you don't.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so terrifying. But you're right. I think if you look at Cardassia, that's why we're supposed to, as the viewer, think, wow, this is a rough place to live.
Yeah.
Because they deal with that every day. People are put behind bars or executed in Cardassia every day that shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah, and there's nothing that anyone can do about it. Like,
they don't have Odo, they don't have Sisko.
Yeah, they don't have like a federation on their side, basically. And so this brings us to we meet O'Brien's lawyer, or I guess it's confusing. It's not his defense attorney. I guess Odo is like his advisor, and this guy is he's Conservator Kovat. He's like, I guess, is his lawyer, basically. And
they make up the legal team, the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. It's like we got
whether they want to or not.
Yeah. It's Alan Dershowitz and Johnny Cochran, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And Kovat is you might have a Six Degrees that relates to this. So I'm not going to go too much into his background, but it's played by the great Fritz Weaving.
I don't, so if you want to elaborate, you can.
So most people are going to know him from he's done a lot of science fiction fantasy stuff. His most famous role is an episode of The Twilight Zone called The Obsolete Man, which coincidentally features a man who's put on trial by an authoritarian state, basically. And the guy, he plays the judge in that trial, but it's a guy who's considered to be obsolete, and that's what he's on trial for. So I wonder, like, I wonder how much, because I mean, I don't doubt at all that the writers of this were huge Twilight Zone fans. So I wonder how much of that influenced Bill Dial's writing, and like the writing room, and like how the episode was like played, because it does have a Twilight Zone feel to it in some ways.
It does, a little
bit.
Or maybe it's more just coincidence, like his agent was like, hey, and sold them on it. Like, you should use this guy because, yeah. Hell, have you seen this Twilight Zone episode?
Yeah, and I would think that, well, Weaver, at that point, he probably has such a career. I would think that they probably sought him out. Like, who, like, they're probably like, well, who's a good character actor that can play these types of roles? And they probably went after him. I don't know for sure, but...
he was good though. He did a good job. The character was kind of annoying, just how committed to this fall system. I love that. I think it made sense too, him being older and nearing retirement, that he's just so entrenched that this whole thing felt like a circus to him.
Oh yeah,
he was so used to just coercing these folks to confess and to cry and to, you know, make a spectacle, that for it to be anything like this was just like, he didn't understand. He didn't see it coming.
Yeah, we learn that his only job is not to help him prove his innocence. It's to help him basically, like, get a confession, as he puts it, based on an old Kardashian expression, confession is good for the soul. And the idea being that, like, it makes the public feel better because it proves that the state is right and that he is repentant and the state's working. It's like he's just a puppet for the system. O'Brien obviously thinks that's ridiculous. Yeah, it's all about just getting order. And Kovat makes a line about, like, have you ever won a case? And he's like, well, winning isn't everything, and walks away. I love the way
he's definitely good for a couple of one-liners.
Oh, yeah. He plays it, like, with just enough levity to where it almost makes it scarier, but it's definitely great. So here's where I start to get, like, shaky on, and I get why they need to do this, but I don't buy who they do it with. So the DS9 crew does their, like, you know, they do their Nancy Drew, and they start looking at all the evidence, and then they start, like, how are we going to get him out of this? They find that 24 photon torpedoes were stolen from a locker. They were beamed out of the locker, and the only person who could do that was an expert in transporters. You may not know this, but that was Chief O'Brien's job on the Enterprise. He was a transporter chief. Obviously he's, like, you know, good with engineering stuff and he's the chief engineer here, but, like, he's obviously the person who would do this if anyone was going to do it at all. So Bashir's like, you know, to Dax, I don't think he's guilty. And this is where I get shaky. Kira steps in and she finds, command logs that verify that O'Brien had done it and his voice prints. It's all very damning evidence. But Kira is so quickly on board with this evidence. And I don't buy that she would be at all. Like, she's so quick to think that, like, oh, well, I guess he must have done it. Look, it's all the evidence is here. And I mean, like, up until this point, everything she's ever done or said to us would have us believe that she wouldn't trust the Cardassians in any way, shape, or form. So, like, I don't understand why she's so quick to throw him under the bus, basically. It felt like her lines need to be given to somebody else, but no other character would have fit the profile. Odo wasn't... Odo, like, those are Odo's lines, but Odo was with O'Brien, so he can't say them. But, like, Bashir's obviously not going to say them because he's going to defend Julian or defend O'Brien no matter what. Sisko probably won't because he's Sisko and he's loyal. Dax isn't invested enough, so I don't... I guess they just gave him to her as just sort of, like, who else is there? But I just don't believe that she would have been so quick to trust the Cardassians ruling on this.
I agree. I totally agree. And I think part of that is because we as a viewer don't even think there's a chance. From the minute this thing happens, the way it develops, we know that there's no chance it was O'Brien. We know that.
Yeah, we know.
So
yeah.
if we aren't even doubting it, then why would Kira?
Yeah, of all
if
people.
If they did a better job plot-wise or what have you, of making us think, well, shit, maybe he did do this.
Yeah.
Then it would be believable. You wouldn't have questioned it. You would be like, oh, shit, yeah, Kira's the one who's onto it because we're onto it. But because nobody who's ever watched the show thought even for a second it was O'Brien, why Kira? You're right. I think that was strange, and it didn't really need to be there.
I think on the one hand, it's because there's no other character who it makes sense with. She's the one who it makes the most. And I think what they were trying to do, it's sort of like the jobber. Like, have you ever heard that phrase? Like the, it's like a wrestling term. Like, well, if Kira believes it, then it must be true. There must be possibility. Like, if she's the one who, right. like, it's like, you know, if they can knock out the big guy, this person's obviously a threat. So, like,
right.
here, like, and I think that's what they were trying to do. Like, if she believes it, then obviously, it. But it just doesn't work. And it's so hard to believe because she's so passionately, like, well, you know, it's there. And, like, she wouldn't be swayed by this for a second. Like, hell, like, 4 episodes ago, we had something similar. And she's like, you can't trust the Cardassians with the Maquis part two. She got into it with Sisko over this. Like, no, the Cardassians are fine.
Why couldn't have Odo just filled that role of the hyper reasonable? Well, it does look bad. And we would have believed that because Odo is kind of at this point to me, you know, more mechanical, more just facts and truth.
Yeah.
And it makes sense for Odo to be like, well, it does look pretty bad, to be honest. It was his voice.
Yeah.
You know, the torpedoes are gone. I'm not so sure it wasn't him. And then you'd be like, okay, that's Odo. That's fine.
Yeah, not even...
But for Kira to put everything aside and just be like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it looks pretty bad, it just didn't make sense. So I agree with you at that part.
I mean, maybe there could have been a scene where Odo... Kira relays the evidence they found to Odo while he's in Cardassia, and Odo kind of is the one that, you know, plays her role, and she's the one that argues it, and then, you know, maybe that's how that could have played out and been more convincing. But yeah, that bothered me a lot more than I think it was supposed to. But it's just so glaring. Like, she's just the one character who is so staunchly anti-Cardassian. I would never believe that she would trust them for a second on anything. No, so
she wouldn't.
So we learn Odo mentions the Mulder thing. And like, yeah, you lost one. That's what they do with the CBI. They don't call it that, but the Cardassian Bureau of Identification. They take a molar out at age 10 for like identification purposes, and so he tells Keiko, well, you can come to the trial because that way the public can see you cry. And it's pretty dark moment. So
yeah, it's sad.
So then Odo's okay, so like and O'Brien kind of starts to play that role, or Odo starts to play that role, like, have you ever talked with the Maquis before? Have you ever sold weapons to them? And Odo kind of realizes, okay, well, maybe he does. He's not sure. He kind of tests him a little bit. Like, maybe he, you know, maybe he isn't responsible. He interrogates him.
Well, I think Odo's intuition is so good that he's just like, I can better prove his innocence if I'm fully convinced. So let me grill him. And if I can grill him, then I'm going to be able to defend him, which actually makes a lot of sense for a lawyer. I mean, isn't that how defense lawyers probably work?
Yeah.
Backwards.
I mean,
it's like, well, if I can grill him, then that's not a good sign because you're about to face the prosecution.
Yeah, if they're determining whether or not they want to take on a client, that when part of that meeting is determining, you know, well, how likely can I get this person off based on how well they, you know, they might interact with me, and the evidence that
he has to believe it first,
right,
before he can make anyone else believe it,
right? So I love, this is my moment of the show, my killing your own clone moment, which I'm going to play that really quick.
Killing your own clone is still murder. Killing your own clone is still murder.
So when Odo and O'Brien are having this talk, I love the way O'Brien sort of kind of doesn't break down, but it's just like, I'm the best person I can be, and I love Starfleet, and like, this is the thing that, like, I have never been questioned as being disloyal. It's ridiculous to think anybody could think that I ever was. I need them to see that. I just thought that was a great, like, O'Brien, like, sort of, like, I want to live moment.
Yeah, it was a nice little moment there.
Moving on. We're running short on time. Moving on. Get to the weapons locker. They do some more investigating, and they figure out that he met up with Raymond Boone at some point. We just get a lot more courtroom stuff where, like, everything, like, every time Odo tries to, like, interject and, like, you know, object or do anything, they kind of tell him to stop. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of comedy with, mm-hmm. Kavat sort of being like, I'm trying, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I thought these scenes were great.
Yeah, I do think that was great. And I think the only reason that they work reasonably is she allows Odo at times to speak and do things out of turn only because she's so cocky and so confident in the sheer power of their law, their legal system, that she's like, fine, you want to say something, go ahead, it's not going to matter. And I think that's her downfall.
Yeah.
Because she's so close to just, you know, putting him in contempt, and she never does. And it's because she's cocky.
Yeah. She lets it go on longer than she needs to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might have worked for them had she, you know, stopped letting him get a word in edgewise. But, like, and it's funny, too. Like, it's almost like a television show for them. Like, they keep talking about, the public hates seeing this. The ratings are going to be bad. Mm-hmm. And, like, he's so worried about, like, yeah. I just love his, like, buffoonery over, like, I can't believe he's arguing for this stuff. Basically, Sisko and the crew, they hold Boone for questioning, and you know, they get him. He plays innocent, like I was talking about. We get a scene with O'Brien, or no, I'm sorry, not O'Brien, Bashir in the infirmary, and there's a guy in the shadows who we can't see, and he mentions that Boone is not a Maquis, because they had suspected that he was a member of the Maquis, and he's like, no, he's not a Maquis. We don't know anything about these warheads. We're not involved with this at all. So you need to go talk to him, which is kind of jarring. I guess it needed to happen, but there's a sense that like it's kind of crazy how deeply the Maquis have infiltrated the station.
Yeah, that he just shows up, talks shit, and disappears.
Yeah, and that means that there's
like wow,
and like they don't quite say this, but I think you're meant to infer that that means that there is a Maquis or more many. Starfleet officers are on the station not saying anything. They're just kind of like wolves in sheep clothing, basically. So it's kind of a neat little bit of tension that they sort of don't spend too much time on, but it's there. So we get more of the arguing. We see some of the outside shots of Cardassia, and like people are watching the trial. You know, they mention that the Maquis are violent killers, and O'Brien helped them, and that's why he's so guilty. So all of a sudden, Sisko walks in with Boone. And this is where we're like, okay, well, obviously Boone's guilty. Like, we knew that all along. And the twist becomes, well, Boone all of a sudden, out of nowhere, divorced his wife of 15 years, left Starfleet, stopped talking to his parents, started acting way out of character. And everybody just sort of chalked it up to his experience as in Set like 3. He was traumatized, PTSD. But Bashir, having done a medical inspection on him, realized he was missing one of his molars. So they do a further DNA scan, and they realize that, oh no, he's a Cardassian. He just underwent surgery to look human and essentially make O'Brien look bad, because this way, now they can sort of publicly condemn the Maquis, and in turn publicly condemn Starfleet. It's actually not a bad plan if you think about it. It's pretty good. It's very Cardassian, because it takes advantage of this tenuous situation, and that was sort of the giveaway. Like, they mentioned that the situation in the Maquis has become untenable. So they needed something to turn the court of public opinion on their side and sort of damn Starfleet. Like, look, no, a Starfleet officer on this station, he's a direct threat to us. But I don't know, what'd you think of this whole thing? Because there's a lot.
I think it's a little bit soap opera-y.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it just turns out he's Cardassian. It's like, well, what do you mean? And I get it. It's budget. It's just like a very easy, like a soap opera where it's like, oh, it's his evil twin. Yeah. It's actually just a twin. It's just your way of explaining away some sort of disguise. So that's a little weird. You know, we already talked about how we focused on him the whole time. So that was a little weird. So it was an afterthought, especially because we didn't see it. We just had Sisko explaining it at the end.
Yeah,
it was at the very end. It was O'Brien was already off, and he just explains, oh, by the way, it turns out it was really his twin brother, basically. Yeah. You know? So that was kind of lame, but I can see why they maybe did that. I don't know.
I like the
episode was still pretty cool.
Yeah, I like the idea of that. I think it just the execution fell a little flat. But I mean, I like this.
What if they showed it? What if they showed it?
Yeah, it could have been cool.
That's my solution. Yeah. Maybe if they showed it.
Yeah.
Like if it showed him Bashir reaching back and being like, is there a molar there? And all of a sudden, like, maybe you see something else, or I don't know, something.
Or he's scanning it and we get a line like, wait a minute, his DNA it's reading as Cardassian. You know, something like that. Who knows?
Maybe it got cut.
It might have been, yeah. I looked in the script. I didn't see anything, but that stuff's not...
That could be Avery Brooks.
Yeah, that stuff's not always in the script, so who knows if it was cut or not, but... I do like that it establishes that this is a thing that Cardassians do, In the same way that, like, we know now we know the Maquis have basically spies aboard the station. How do we know that we don't have any more, surgically altered Cardassian spies running around the Federation or anywhere else for that matter? It's kind of a neat, like, world building thing, like, that it establishes for them.
For sure.
We get more of their trial where, and another good moment was, Makbar asking O'Brien how many Cardassians he's killed. And he's just like, well, I haven't done any since the war, but if you want me to ask, you know, for the war, I don't know. But, eventually she quotes him as saying, did you say the bloody Cardies can't be trusted?
How did they know that?
Well, again, and I think that's one of those things where they probably have him under surveillance. Because you got to think, like, he was a person of interest. I mean, he's on this, like, very, like, contentious station. He was at war with the Cardassians at one point. He served aboard the Enterprise. So he's probably someone they watch pretty heavily. So that, I thought that was just a little creepy. Like, oh, they clearly keep tabs on him. And who knows who else. But then Kovat, it just completely, like... They let O'Brien go. He goes back into Federation custody because once they see Boone, once Makbar sees Boone, she knows, oh, the jig is up. Okay, we gotta let him go. And obviously, look at how good the system works. You know, the system's so great. We see that he can be rehabilitated, and she just flips the script completely on their whole spiel.
Yeah, very cunning.
yeah, very Cardassian. And I love the Kovac just completely, like, incredulous. Like, what the hell just happened? Odo's like, you won. And then they'll kill me. I might plug that in, actually, because it's the you won, yeah. They'll kill me. That's pretty good. And then it just kind of ends. Like, yeah, we learn everything, and then it's just kind of over. So, I don't know. We kind of went over that, like, our thoughts on that ending. But, I don't know, what do you think of... did you have a favorite moment in this episode?
I don't know. We did get to see Colmini's man body, which I love.
Oh, yeah, we did.
In this day and age where everyone has to be ripped. I just love his just like...
pudgy.
Fleshy, regular, just regular dude, like shirtless. Because it's not the first time we've seen him shirtless.
Nope.
It's funny, we keep seeing him without his shirt off, which is fine. I think it's great. It's refreshing.
Yeah, I know. I appreciate that. Like, he's just the kind of a pudgy dude. He's not like... he clearly shaves it all off. And it's just, yeah, I appreciate that. He's not an Adonis.
Maybe that's my favorite.
Yeah, can you imagine if it was now, he would be, like, ripped.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or at least in better shape than that.
For sure.
Looks like he has never really lifted a weight in his life.
Probably not, no. It definitely made me feel better, that's for sure.
Hey, no offense, Colmini.
No, no offense at all.
Sure, I look like that too. Yeah, that's me. So,
God, other than that, I can't think of any other thoughts I had in this episode.
It's kind of fun.
It was funny. It was okay. Like, you know, I think there were some inconsistent spots. Wasn't as strong as I remembered, but it had some fun stuff. There's, you know, it's nice to see Avery Brooks behind the camera. It's kind of a Star Trek tradition, like... the actors at some point all get a turn behind the camera. So that's cool. But other than that, do you have a 6 degrees?
I do, yes. Right. It's now time. Do you have a little slot song for me?
I do.
Six.
Six?
My favorite number is six.
So for today's 6 degrees of Cisco, brought to you in part by EmeraldCityComics.com. Get all your best comics and toys, Star Trek included, at EmeraldCityComics.com. Anyways, this is a good one. I'm a little proud of this. So in this episode, Tribunal, one of our guest stars was, of course, Makbar, the merciless judge, played by Carolyn Lagerfeld. Now, Carolyn Lagerfeld is a pretty successful actress. And she is supposedly, not that I knew, most known as Cece Rhodes on Gossip Girl.
Never seen it.
You know Gossip Girl?
Never watched it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just like a soap opera type thing with a bunch of hot young people. Speaking of hot young people, it includes the smoke show Blake Lively.
Ooh.
And the
wife of Ryan Reynolds, right?
Correct, who's also a smoke show.
Yeah.
That's a handsome guy.
Hell yeah.
Anyways, Blake Lively, I think that's kind of how she made it big, was Gossip Girl. But she was also, maybe even won an award for her performance in The Town, because she's a very like Boston Southie kind
of character. Is that the Affleck or Casey Affleck or yes. one of those?
Yeah, heist movie.
Okay, I never saw it.
And Blake Lively is like plays a very like kind of, I don't know how else to say, but kind of like trashy, like, so she's like way out of her element. She does a great job.
Right.
Anyways, of course, in the town you got Ben Affleck and you've got Jeremy Renner,
Hawkeye,
who does a convincing Boston accent. Of course, he is Hawkeye in the Avengers.
Yep.
And he is in the Avengers along with Hulk, who is played by was it Steve Bannon? What's his name?
Mark
Dr. Banner.
Bruce Banner. Yeah. Mark Ruffalo.
Bruce Banner is played by Mark Ruffalo. And Mark Ruffalo is in a rom-com called Just Like Heaven in 2005, which, like all good rom-coms, features Reese Witherspoon.
Of course.
And, I hope I'm not missing a step here. And Reese Witherspoon is in... Oh, no, hold on. Oh, okay.
Just remember, I can...
No, okay. We're good. Nope, don't edit me. Do not edit me. We're still on track. Reese Witherspoon. So Just Like Heaven is Reese Witherspoon and Mark Ruffalo. But also, in Just Like Heaven is Rosalind Chow.
Yeah. Keiko.
So Rosalind Chow. So Keiko.
Holy shit.
So I was proud of this one because we haven't gone back to Keiko, Rosalind Chow. And she was in Just Like Heaven. So I didn't need to use Reese Witherspoon. It was straight Mark Ruffalo to Rosalind Chow.
Wow, I had no clue. I think that is your best one yet, because that, I was not expecting Keiko. I was expecting anyone else.
Yeah, so some decent flicks in there, but there's always a connection, so there's always 6 degrees somewhere.
Yeah, that was definitely surprising. One more thing I just noticed, I was looking at the credits of this. Jake Sisko, Sirik Lofton is credited as being in this episode, but he's not here. So I wonder if he had deleted scene or something that.
I haven't seen him in forever. What is he doing? Finals or something?
He's definitely in the next one. He's definitely aging up. So we're gonna see a lot more of him. But next week, we're talking about the last episode of season 2, the Gem Hadar. This is a big one. This is also gonna be our 50th episode. So that's. Wow. Hopefully we'll have something special planned for that. We'll see. On a camping trip in the Gamma Quadrant, Sisko, Jake, Nog, and Quark encounter the ruthless soldiers of the Dominion, the Gem Hadar.
Wow. And they're camping? I love it.
Yeah, they go camping. So get some hot dogs.
I love it.
Maybe meet Harry.
Some marshmallows, some s'mores.
It's basically Harry the Hendersons, but without... other than that, wormholepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening as always. I've been your host, Poey Corden.
Yep.
You can find me on Twitter @ThePoey, where I'm usually complaining about something or another. Other than that, we'll be back next week. And that's it. Anything else?
No, thanks for listening.
All right.
See you next time. Bye.
Sorry, my cat. It's like one of those things.
Since you're gonna edit this out anyways, can I just say that the Skype call flipped? I don't know why. I can't explain why. But you exited stage right into, I don't know, another room for your cat. And it flipped while you were gone. Huh. So you popped in. You were just literally like, whoop, 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 whoop.